Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the Weekly Roundup, where we take a look back at last week's biggest issues, dissect them, analyze them, and try and make it all make sense. As my host and regular sparring partner, Diwa, is still out of action, I'll be joined again by Nathan Smith. How are you, Nathan?
Pretty well. Looking forward to this. Enjoyed myself last time.
Great. Well, let's get into it. The first issue is Candace Owens. So Candace Owens, as we know, is a somewhat controversial conservative commentator from the US, African-American woman. Used to work at the Daily Wire before there was some sort of falling out over issues to do with anti-Semitism and also some other conspiratorial type issues. But she's still been relatively successful since going her own way from the Daily Wire. And she's recently booked herself on a speaking tour of Australia and New Zealand, which is in this month, November, I believe. However, the Australian government has recently revoked or denied her a visa to enter the country on grounds that she will stir up social discontent and this sort of thing. And in particular, a lot of the impetus for this seems to be coming from the due to the fact that her views or the things she says are viewed as anti-Semitic. So there's a bit of a suspicion that Jewish groups, Jewish lobbies are influencing the government to try and prevent Candace Owens from coming in. So what's your reaction to this development, Nathan?
Well, you can come at this from a couple of angles. First, from a state's angle, from international law's perspective, I actually don't mind that decision. I think every state should be able to deny or allow access to anybody they want. I think that sort of power is requisite for any sort of modern state. So, the United States saying that it doesn't want someone, Australia saying that it doesn't want someone in there like Candace Owens is perfectly within their prerogative. I don't think that should be forced back at all. But on top of that, it sort of makes me suspicious why everybody gets so excited about American commentators coming to discuss issues that really don't have much to do with them. If I could have my own way, if I could suggest policy structure, I think we should just assume that everything across the Pacific Ocean towards the east is just more ocean. We actually should be ignoring what a lot of American political commentators say. We have plenty of good talent here to discuss pretty crucial problems that are domestic to New Zealand. And, although Candace Owens might have some stuff to say that's universal, she has nothing to do with us. So even the invite here kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I think it's a waste of time. However, from the free speech angle, I would say everybody should be allowed to talk to whatever point they want, because I guess sunlight is the best disinfectant, to use that cliche, and debate is better than censorship. But again, I just go back to the point of why are we even bothering to listen to an American in the first place? So I guess that's kind of where I'd come out.
Yeah. Well, in my view, it can be helpful to have, large, big name kind of celebrity influences like Candace come into your country, because they can bring attention to political issues, important political issues. And also, it sort of focuses sort of the gaze, I guess, of the international community more on a problem in a particular country. And it can help sort of mobilize, in the case of free speech, for example, it can help mobilize a sort of international free speech community to help lobby against censorship restrictions that may be in one country. This is a sort of dynamic that I've observed several times over the last few years since I've been involved in free speech. Although the forces campaigning for censorship within your country can often be stronger than the free speech forces within your country, if you can team up with free speech promoters in other countries against the domestic censorship promoters, that can be a very useful way of promoting free speech, but it would also work for other issues. So I've called this thing sort of influence arbitrage in the past, and I think that's really useful. But just on the sort of the free speech fundamentals here, like, people should be able to make whatever arguments they want. And the way to counter arguments that you don't like is obviously with more speech rather than censorship. And it backfires on the censors anyway. Like Candace Owens and whatever Candace Owens' views are on issues of anti-Semitism or conspiratorialism, those views are getting much more attention now than they would otherwise. So I think the censorship is sort of failing. But the other problem here is with the New Zealand government looks like it's at least considering following a suit of what the Australian government has done. So they haven't made a decision, as far as I know yet, but let's hope that they don't follow suit there. Okay, I'll move on now to the next issue, and that's the news that the Southport stabber, this is unbelievable, this really got my goat, this issue. The news that the Southport stabber, he had in his possession Al-Qaeda training materials, Al-Qaeda materials for how to do terrorist attacks and various things, and he was also manufacturing or making the poison ricin. And the authorities are actually charging this guy with offences under the Terrorism Act and under the the Biological Weapons Act. I can't remember the exact name of the second act, but it's something like that. Now, these are the British authorities that told us that they stressed it very strongly at the time when the protesters in the UK were going about their business, protesting, you know, making it known that they were uncomfortable and they disliked what had happened here and the British government's policies of allowing people like this into the country. The British authorities were very insistent that this wasn't related to Islamic terror. The guy wasn't a terrorist. We don't know what his motivations are. And if you said anything otherwise, you were guilty of spreading mis or disinformation. And they actually arrested people who said it might be a terror attack or it might be a Muslim or it might be an instance of Islamic terror. There are people who said those things who were put in jail, but they were correct. Or at least they've got a very, very strong case. And the authorities knew that all along. They knew that this guy did have some sort of connection to Islamic terrorism while they were insisting that it was mis and disinformation for the other people to say it. So this is atrocious Orwellian censorship behavior from the UK government. And I think some sort of apology or something is owed to the people. People are in jail because the government lied and they accused the people who were telling the truth of lying and they put them in jail. And that's terrible. Do you have a similar view to that, Nathan, or is your view somewhat different?
Yeah, in the broad, I would say you're right. The looking at hindsight now, it does look like a crime scene from the government. But I think, and I hate playing devil's advocate all the time, but I have to look at this from the state's perspective. So if we play the timeline out, the murders in July were, you know, on the media fairly quickly. People started to see this. It was pushed around social media rapidly, as social media tends to do. It was picked up by at least a few individuals, one of whom, according to my research, to your point, correctly stated that this was probably Islamic terrorism based or related. The result of that in the real world, had that stayed in the social media world, that probably would have been okay. But it actually bled out into the real world, causing a number of British people to go to mosques, surround those mosques, and begin to get rather agitated. Now, if I'm sitting there as the police chief or the nudge unit in the UK, SIS, for instance, I'm thinking this could kick off pretty badly and turn into a lynch mob in multiple locations around Britain. And innocent people could get brought up in this. The first thing I'm going to do if I'm the state is I'm going to intervene in the spread, the virality of this misinformation and disinformation. I might even call it those words just to sort of play this down, because it could have gotten ugly pretty quick. There's a lot of animosity. As those protests prove, there's a lot of animosity. People are more radicalized than the state wants to believe. And there are a lot of people that sought opportunity, whether consciously or unconsciously, to take those frustrations out on the Muslim community that were there. So from the state's perspective, at the time, although it looks ugly and criminal today, it was probably the least worst thing that they could have done was to sort of intervene in that point and describe that information, correct as it was, as misinformation. And so, you know, we're looking back at it now in November, and yes, it does need to come clean that the government lied. But that balance between how do we solve for the social media world and the consequences in the real world, with information that moves faster than the state can react. This is not just the problem that the UK is going through. It's all over Europe. It's all over New Zealand and Australia. And I think that issue, although ugly in hindsight, was probably the least bad thing that the United Kingdom could have done. On the other hand, the lie that it actually had to choose there now makes it very difficult to believe London or Westminster about anything. How does a state retain competency and influence with the population when it is proven at a fairly quick half-life, by the way, so we're only a couple of months after July, it is proven categorically that it lied to those people for we don't know's purpose, but I've just outlined at least one purpose. The next time the state decides to say something, people will just lose trust in it. People will not allow it to be persuasive anymore. People will decide to circumvent those jurisdictional problems. And this is not easy for a lot of states when things like this happen, but it is something that they're going to have to start tackling. So that's probably where I would come through on this.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with your sort of the last reason you gave there against what the state was doing. And a couple of other points I would make there, though, is that it's the state that's responsible in large part for bringing a lot of these immigrant communities into England and Britain and the UK that has created the powder keg situation to start with. So they can give themselves a kick up the bum for doing that one since they've created the situation to start with.
I thought the most egregious thing was actually calling the terrorist himself Welsh. I mean, just historically speaking, the Welsh have probably the most robust claim to be the indigenous population of Britain. So to call this guy, who's very clearly a Rwandan, a Welshman, it just encapsulates the whole problem that the United Kingdom has actually found itself in at the moment. It actually doesn't know what a Briton is anymore. That in itself was misinformation, calling him a Welshman. And so again, these lies sort of are stacked up on top of each other, that when something like this happens, the consequences, as you say, of Britain's choices over a number of years, it doesn't know where to turn, so it chooses the least worst option. And believe me, there were worse options than this. It could have just gone with the misinformation and let those lynch mobs occur, which actually probably would have been a bit of a release valve for a lot of people who are frustrated about the consequences that the state had, to your point, created for itself. So this is just going to compound, and if this is just going to be harder and harder until the British state itself and others around the world decide to tell the truth about the situation they found themselves in and face consequences for those decisions from the populace. Whether it happens at the ballot box or some other avenue is really up to history. But all debts must be paid in full, and the state at the moment has a lot of debts with its own people.
Yeah, I mean, institutional trust and credibility are, I think Jordan Peterson says something like they're difficult and slow things to build, but easy things to tear down and destroy. And I think that this sort of short-term thinking, this sort of short-term crisis management, it has that effect. It sort of erodes trust over time. But the other point I would make is whether this clamp down on the problem, try and contain it, approach, you know, contain the narrative, whether that actually does more good than harm is something else that I find questionable. I mean, I think a lot of people became more agitated when they saw the unfairness of what the state was doing, particularly the way they seemed to tolerate and protect and maybe even encourage a lot of the Muslim or largely Muslim pro-Palestine, anti-Israel protests that were going through London in, you know, previous weeks and months. And the way they reacted to this protest, these protests seemed a lot different. They wanted to contain it. They called them violent thugs. They said they were spreading misinformation. So that fed into the whole idea of two-tier care and two-tier policing. So the other thing I question just whether this sort of contain the narrative, call it mis and disinformation, call them violent thugs, I'd question whether that approach really does make the problem better rather than worse. I think we'll move on, unless you've got anything else to say about that.
That's fine.
Okay, next subject I've got here, Pauline Hanson. So Pauline Hanson has been involved in a trial over racial vilification. So she she got into an argument on Twitter, and I think perhaps in other Apple News as well, with a Pakistani immigrant senator, I think, in Australia. And she's been found guilty of racial vilification because she told her to piss off back to Pakistan or something like that. But what's interesting about this is that that comment from Pauline Hanson actually came in response to a comment from the other person, that it was something like, I find it hard to celebrate or to mourn the death of the Queen because she's the leader of, you know, a racist, colonialist empire, words to that effect. And to me, that is arguably just as hateful and just as insulting as anything that Pauline Hanson said. So I think there's two things here. First of all, you should be able to say things that are a little bit hateful and a little bit insulting, in my view. Like, political arguments get heated sometimes, and that's okay, and we should have a little bit of tolerance for it. But the crackdown, the court case here is very one-sided. It's saying that what Pauline Hanson did is hateful and racial vilification. But the comments of the Pakistani senator, we won't worry about them. There's nothing wrong with them. Your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, Pauline Hanson has a colourful history. She is obviously very excitable, but I don't think the problem is with her. I think by proxy, what she's bumped up against actually is a very long tradition, I would say, in the West, leading back to, you know, well before any of us were born, between kind of what you would broadly talk as the settlers versus the colonists, the missionaries versus the settlers, which is, you know, still going on today. The settlers have sort of roundly lost, I think, the high ground in the discussion in the Western world, especially the colonies like Australia and New Zealand. And the missionaries kind of won pretty resoundingly. And the funny thing about the missionaries, so broadly speaking, I'm not really only discussing Christians here. What I'm talking about is the people who were sort of categorically opposed to everything that certain colonialist actions from Europe towards the settler mindset encompassed. That actually is a pretty worldwide movement. There is this feeling of anti-colonialism, anti-West, anti-settler stuff in Pakistan. It's in India. It's for large parts in Africa and Latin America. It's all over the place. It is especially prevalent in places like the colonies, like New Zealand and Australia. That cultural force actually, that Pakistani example you were just pointing out there, is completely in control of the narrative. And he actually, or that person, was actually representing that cultural force. And so when Pauline Hanson stands up and says, you should go back to Pakistan, what she probably doesn't realize she's doing is talking to the establishment. She's talking to a proxy that is acting on behalf of a janissary, if you will, someone who is bought and paid for in their own heads to defend this cultural force that's been going on for at least 200 years, which is, as I say, has as its in its bullseye everything to do with colonialist mindset, European ideas, and settler concepts. So if this is the world that the Australians want to live within, then that's fine. That's what they voted for. But you can't really tell somebody to go back to Pakistan if your cultural force, if your cultural hegemony is, well, anybody should be able to go anywhere, and there's no such thing as goodness from the Western's perspective. Everything is relative. That force is actually huge, and I don't think Pauline Hanson realized what she bumped into.
That's interesting. I mean, I think the you're right that there's a huge sort of cultural force opposed to what Pauline Hanson was saying there. But I think in a way it's good to, it's definitely good to fight back against that. And, you know, like courage in doing that sort of thing inspires others to do the same. And, you know, every action has an equal but opposite reaction. I mean, I think most people are coming around. I mean, I could be overly optimistic here. I think most people are coming around now to the point of view that this cultural force has gone too far and needs to be pushed back. And more ordinary people are willing now, in my sort of observation, and they're becoming more willing all the time, that the force is building behind a pushback against this. And that's you're seeing that happen in numerous ways. And our conversation here, RCR, is sort of part of that countervailing social movement. So I sort of view it that way.
Mm. But that force that you rightly point out is growing does need to understand the size, the breadth, the depth of the enemy, so to speak, the adversary, so to speak. And it's more of a mindset, and it goes back a long way in history, and it has been gathering pace and momentum for a long time. And, you know, a lot of both of us would probably be considered very liberal to our great grandparents, for instance. You know, that to use a phrase, that Overton window has gone leftwards very, very far since then. We would be considered anathema to the first settlers that came to New Zealand and Australia. If you read about those people, they were fully embracing the idea of building a new land. Today, we're almost embarrassed to talk about our own grandparents. And I think that's something we need to sort of excise from our own minds first before we can even dream about attacking this cultural force.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with you, but I want to end on a sort of positive and hopeful note, and you're cutting against me there. But anyway, we'll move on. The Australian COVID inquiry has been released. The sort of headline that's come out of that is that the overbearing nature of the COVID response in Australia has contributed to a lack of trust in the authorities. And there's a number of other things that have gone on there as well. The report talks about the negative effects on children of schools being closed. The thing, I guess, that a lot of people are upset about, a lot of people, particularly in the RCR community, is that one of the headline findings from the report was that the reason the response would have been better if the vaccines had been rolled out faster. So that the report is critical of the slow rollout of vaccines in Australia. And I mean, I guess my view is that, you know, the vaccine was, if not a waste of time, it was more than a waste of time. It was actually did more harm than good. So the other finding that's come out of that report is this recommendation that's been followed immediately by funding from the Australian Labor government to set up a Centre for Disease Control that's going to have significant powers in terms of surveillance, gathering people's health information, and also having, I mean, I've read through, I haven't read it cover to cover, but I've read large parts of it. It's also going to be developing strategies for countering mis and disinformation related to the pandemic. And this will include things like how to control the narrative or counter unfavorable narratives, and working with social media providers, experts, and influencers in order to do that. So this, it just looks like they're institutionalizing and they're embedding a lot of the really negative things that people didn't like about the COVID response into this big new institution that they're going to roll out next time there's a pandemic. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, whether you agree with my sort of first take of it there, or have you got this?
Yeah, huge skepticism about this. I mean, the classic example is in the United States, where in order to fund a certain war back in the early 20th centuries, they introduced an income tax and they said it was temporary. Well, nothing the government ever does, if it's useful for them, is temporary. The United States is still dealing with an income tax today. This was actually one of the criticisms that I remember very smart people back in early 2020 were saying, look, if you create these sorts of institutions, these sort of agencies, there needs to be a very clear definition of victory conditions. How do you know you've won? And then can you take them, or can you actually reverse those policies? If those pathways aren't built into the actual institution you're creating, you shouldn't be doing it, because they just become this constant, ever-increasing beast that those working inside it can completely rationalize as being good, useful, you know, politically moral, that sort of stuff. They can do that till the cows come home. But the real effects on people, especially with misinformation, disinformation units, is less political speech, less social trust, less political trust. And the government can't see that. All it can see is it's got this nice, shiny new toy or weapon, depending on how it wields it, and that it's not going to give that up, because if there's a risk, a palpable risk, you know, a non-zero risk of a new pandemic coming through, it may need that in the future. So it needs to hold on to these toys or weapons, depending on which way you want to use them. And this isn't always the case with the government, which is why they need to be nipped in the bud. It wasn't, because back in 2020, rightly or wrongly, everybody was scared, you know, crazy about COVID by that very government that is now setting up this actual institution. But the only way they could have gotten out of it in 2022 was to roll out the vaccine and to give immunity to the pharmacological companies that were rolling that out. And it was a deal done with the devil with those big pharma companies, because they hadn't actually tested the vaccines. And now we're starting to see these inquiries sort of come through political systems around the world showing that that's actually the case. But there's no recourse to this because, again, they've been given immunity. All the officials have been given immunity. They move sideways. They move up and around. We didn't know their names. And they just sort of gotten away with it. And these inquiries are important. They're sort of maybe a full stop at certain parts of history. And they'll go on some big desk somewhere and just be forgotten. But we shouldn't really forget. And the next time, you know, the government decides to scare us, we should really look closely at the measures they're putting in place to protect us, because sometimes they just don't go away.
Yeah. There are several, well, the Senator Pauline Hanson, who we've just talked about, she's calling for a new inquiry, a new Royal Commission of Inquiry into the COVID response over there, to examine some of these other questions a bit more deeply, particularly around like things like vaccine injuries. I mean, I don't know if this is specifically something she's calling for, but I guess the other questions are around the safety and efficacy of the vaccine, you know, vaccine injuries, excess deaths, I guess, would be another one, all these sorts of questions. So I wonder whether they're going to get, I mean, we've kind of got, with Winston Peters getting in with the, you know, New Zealand First, we kind of have our phase two inquiry here in New Zealand. I wonder whether they're going to get their Royal Commission of Inquiry over there.
Well, it needs to have teeth. Whatever happens to it, there needs to be punitive measures for people who have been shown with clear evidence that they step past the law. And that law needs to be very clear. And the lawyers need to be justified in putting these people in front of courts. That's got to be hard, because civil servants are really good about obfuscating their roles in certain criminal acts. Whether they were criminal at the time, because you can't be prosecuted for something that's a law now but wasn't when you did it. There's lots of different ways that they can wiggle around in this. But, you know, there does need to be examples made of people who made poor decisions based on evidence they knew was wrong, and that they've hurt people because of that. And the government does need to make its case for that. And I think that should be more of the thrust. It needs to be gathering evidence to show clear states of misconduct. If it can't do that, then any inquiry is just going to be a waste of taxpayers' money. But I would encourage the government to start thinking more seriously about shedding some light on some misconduct.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, people need to be held accountable. Okay, let's move on to the US election. So things are coming to a head there, and we're going to very shortly see what the result is, what the final result of all this is. Now, in the recent week or so, both Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have made an appearance on the Joe Rogan podcast. And I just thought that this was an interesting feature, because it shows how much the information landscape has changed and where you need to go in order to reach potential voters and to reach a large audience. Joe Rogan has the largest podcast in the world, and the number of people that he reaches, it rivals or exceeds like mainstream avenues. Like you could go on CNN, you know, you can get something written about you in the New York Times. But going on the Joe Rogan podcast is arguably gives you even more reach. It's more of a status symbol yet, but it's sort of trending in that direction just because he's got so much reach. So what do you make of this sort of change in the information landscape where politicians are going to get their message out? Can we draw any sort of conclusions from that?
Yeah, some preliminary ones. I mean, I did watch both interviews. I'll sort of move to that shortly, I suppose. But broadly speaking, there's been a bit of a rule of thumb, shall we say, in media for most of my career and definitely earlier, that people's attention spans are like goldfish. You know, you need to give them quick bites of little things because they just really don't have the time or the inclination to dig into stuff. Well, the advent of podcasts completely disproves that. Joe Rogan's interviews are regularly on that three-hour time boundary. 3 hours. And, you know, whether or not some people skip to the end or skip to certain parts or put it on to 1.5 or 2x speed just to speed up the cadence of people's discussions, that's beside the point. There's a lot of time investment just to listen to a handful of people talk. Now, some psychologists have said that this is part of what some people call parasocial relationships. So you feel like you're in the room with two people talking, you know something about both of those people, so you can kind of convince yourself that they're your friends. And this might be something that you would do. You would enjoy a three-hour conversation with a handful of your guy friends or your girlfriends, and you would just sit for 3 hours. That's what you would do. And with a parasocial relationship, it's just one way. They don't know anything about you, but you feel like you know a lot about the two people that you're watching on podcasts. And with loneliness epidemic going through the West, you know, podcasts are obviously a good place to for lonely people to end up, basically, which you couldn't do with the news anchors. You know, they read the news out in a very sterile, antiseptic manner, and you didn't know who they were. Big blue eyes telling you about today's news. But who were these people? Joe Rogan, I know probably more about his life just through his podcast than I probably do about, you know, my cousin. And that's just the way things are. So there's that reality. But it also proves that, you know, if you can go onto a Joe Rogan podcast or any podcast beyond an hour and a half or 2 hours and hold the attention of both the host and the audience, you're really passing a marathon test. You know, if you're keeping people engaged at that level, that says something about your ability to communicate, your charisma, your knowledge of the world, and whatever message you're pushing through. I've watched podcasts that really should have been a 15-minute or a 10-minute interview. You know, at some point, both of them just run out of steam, and yet they've got 45 minutes to 90 minutes to fill, and it's just awkward. So not every guest can do that, but that's the difference. Those who can really are leaning into this new media landscape where people just want to listen to you for whatever reason, and you better know your stuff. And both J.D. Vance and Trump proved in a live conversation that they could go to level two, level three. They could go sideways in tangents. They could respond to questions. They sounded human. You know, that old test of could you have a beer with this person was really passed with both. And I wanted to listen to all 3 hours, and I did. And I felt like the time went by. I looked up from playing solitaire on my phone, because that's how I sort of pass the time, sort of keeping my fingers busy regularly to listen to them with concentration. And I think they passed all those tests.
Yeah, your point about long-form interviews, I think, is a great point. We've really seen a resurgence in long-form interviews, people going into real depth and real detail about complex topics. And we were told that you know, your ordinary person wasn't interested in that anymore, but it seems like there's a real demand for that sort of stuff there. The other point, my big picture takeaway of this sort of podcast phenomenon, not just Joe Rogan, but the sort of disintegration, I guess, of the media market, the rise of sort of independent media providers, podcasters, and the sort of variety of information sources people are getting their information from, is that, you know, I liken this in a way to the creation of the printing press, right? And when you think about the creation of the printing press, the huge sort of social and cultural and geopolitical consequences that arose from that, you had the printing press, you had the Reformation, you had the Catholic Church got depowered. It really led that just the dissemination of knowledge and the ability to think things through for themselves, read the Bible themselves, rather than have it sort of, and what's the correct term, disintermediated by the clergyman, telling them what the Bible said in the church. It really sort of had a drastic, revolutionary geopolitical consequences. And it sort of, not just geopolitical, but political, it revolutionized the way we live. And it changed Europe, Catholic Europe. You had different countries coming in, you know, the birth of nationalism, huge upheavals that came about because the Catholic Church, which used to basically control all the flows of information, now couldn't do it anymore. And mainstream media now can't control all the flows of information anymore. They've got these independent voices breaking in, giving people new and sometimes revolutionary ways to think. And I think that's having a large, I think that's the main driver of the changes we're seeing in people's political preferences. I think that drove the Brexit decision. It drove the rise of Donald Trump. I think it's driving the rise of right-wing parties in Europe and elsewhere, nationalist parties, anti-immigration sentiment. It's encouraging people to go against a lot of the green stuff, a lot of the climate change stuff. It's having these huge effects. Ideas matter, and he who controls the ideas that are going into people's brains really has a lot of power. And when you sort of democratize, and I don't know if liberalize is the right word, but you know, democratize and you allow other players in, it really shakes things up. So that's what I would say about that. I wonder if you.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this sort of stuff all day, as you and I both know. But I would just say one other thing to that is there's no such thing as a free lunch. I certainly agree that new media always precedes a revolution in political framing. You know, history is very clear on that. But the other thing most people are complaining about these days is like a feeling of deracination or a feeling of uprootedness, a feeling of, as Heidegger would have said, thrownness or something, where you just don't know quite where you are. And one of the benefits, I suppose, with a monolithic media is that it sets the narrative very well for what it means to be X or Y. And, you know, there was a time not too long ago, I remember it distinctly, when everybody would tune in at 7:30, you know, the majority of New Zealand, and they would watch something on TV. And then they would talk about that the next day around the water cooler at work. And it was a shared culture. Now, you could say, look, that shared culture was just as manufactured as anything you see in Hollywood. And I think a lot of people are certainly, you know, questioning, hang on, the things that I think are New Zealand, you know, gumboots and rugby and, you know, Billy T. James and all that sort of stuff. How much of that stuff was legitimate and organic, and how much of it was just generated by TVNZ? It's just that we all watched it at the same time in the evenings. And I think so. We're sort of woken up from that dream. We're trying to decide what parts of the dream was real now. And I think when you disintermediate the media like this, you're not really going to be able to fall back to sleep. You won't be able to go back to that dreamland, which was everybody agreed with what a New Zealander was. And, you know, the disintermediation of the media is just going to exacerbate that trend where a handful of people, probably thousands, will listen to Trump and Vance on Joe Rogan. But most other people in different clouds in New Zealand won't know who Joe Rogan is. So there's no ability to jump between those boundaries to create some sort of a shared culture. So I don't know what's coming next. I do know that the media is having the disinformation, the median of the media is going to have an effect on that. Whether it will be positive or not is up to us. But like I said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Change changes everything. And now we have to redecide what it means to have a culture. And I suppose whatever comes out of that, whatever media will have a role in that.
Yeah, this is a huge topic. I think I could talk to you about this for, you know, as on end, but we'll move on. The next thing, the next US election topic. So there's a series of events that happened. Trump had his big campaign rally in Madison Square Garden. Huge, huge venue, iconic venue, huge rally. But the thing that really came out of that was a comedian who was sort of an opening act for Trump. He called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage or something like that. And that this spurred a change in campaign tactic, I think, from the Harris campaign, where they decided, right, we're just going to call him a racist, we're going to call him a Nazi, we're going to throw everything we can at him with these, you know, accusations of Hitlerism, and to see if we can sort of take him down. It's like a hail, their last great Hail Mary. And so they were doing that strategy, they're trying to carry it out. But then along comes old Uncle Joe. He's on a video conference with someone, and then he says, well, the only thing that's garbage is the Trump supporters. And to me, I just thought that just blew all their tactics out of the window, because all the campaign rhetoric about Trump being divisive and being racist and degrading certain people, he's just sort of reversed it and thrown it back in their face. It brought to mind for me Hillary Clinton's famous basket of deplorables comment. Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, by making this comment, they've just said that the half of the country that votes for the other guy are worthless, horrible, garbage people. I think that's enough to lose an election, just like that. So Trump, to capitalize on this, he's come along and he's done a campaign event driving a garbage truck and wearing the fluoro vest and giving a speech. Fantastic stuff. I can see you're enjoying it, smiling at me talking about it. What's your reaction to all this stuff?
Yeah, no, I don't have much more to add, really. It was a It is the last gasp of the Democrats, who kind of realize that the person they put up for being president is probably the worst person they could have picked from 300 million people, and that there's really no runway left. Like this is take off or die for them. And if they had anything compromising on Trump, they've had a long time to get it and release it. And there's just nothing. I mean, the guy is very transparent, but they actually had the FBI digging into his background and still haven't been able to find anything. So that avenue has been shut off. All they really got left is racism, and you know, and a lot of people are learning to sort of ignore that noise at the moment. I think it's funny that you make a connection between Hillary Clinton and her gaffe and Biden's gaffe. I would actually kind of point out that that might be apples and oranges for one very specific reason, which on the J.D. Vance interview, he made the point that he actually kind of wants to go and shake Biden's hand after this election campaign because he thinks he's actually a secret Trump supporter. And two examples he used there was when it had nothing to do with Trump at the time, but he was given, as a joke, I assume, from his supporters, a MAGA hat, Make America Great Again hat. This is a couple of months ago now. And Biden put it on in front of the cameras, kept it on, and then also said loudly, "I'm going to keep this," in his sort of dementia-ridden, smiley sort of way. And now, you know, this week, he decides to call, you know, 50% of the country garbage. Now, when Hillary Clinton did this, she collapsed her campaign. I don't think it was, you know, James Comey, the FBI director, reopening the case into her server that actually did it. I think that was way too esoteric for people. They don't know what a server is, and they don't know, certainly don't really care about who James Comey was. What really got people was being called deplorable, like they didn't belong as Americans. I think a lot of Trump supporters at the time were annoyed by that, and more supportive of Trump for his anti-immigration stance, or at least controls on immigration. This time around, I actually think I agree with J.D. Vance. Biden is not even quietly, but he's very annoyed that there was a soft coup to replace him with the presidential candidate, Kamala Harris. He wanted to run again. Everyone kind of knew that he probably couldn't, but I think he's smart enough and still together enough to kind of know what happened. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's playing a little bit of a game to undermine his party's candidate. That's the conspiracy theory I like to believe in my head. It fits all the facts, yeah, motive, all that sort of thing. It would be curious if I was in like a God position to see what everybody was actually thinking. But I like to believe that, and I think it's helped Trump's campaign immensely. So maybe you should play that one for size.
Oh, well, thank you. Good on you, Joe. Nicely done. Okay, I think we'll move on to New Zealand now, New Zealand issues, and we'll have to do this in kind of rapid fire sort of way to try and get them in because we're chewed up a lot of time on international. So the first one I wanted to talk about was Aisha Viral. Her sister-in-law has been working in Casey Costello, the Associate Minister of Health's office. Without the minister being informed that she's Aisha Viral's sister-in-law. And this comes against the backdrop of a whole bunch of leaks coming out against Casey Costello for her being in bed with the tobacco industry, secretly liaising with them or whatever the allegations are to lower the excise tax on cigarettes and all this sort of stuff. So Winston Peters has come out strongly in Parliament and to defend his minister, and rightly so, because this conflict wasn't declared. Chris Hipkins has sort of, you know, waded in a kind of poor fashion and called her a distant relative, which turns out she's not really that distant. How big a scandal is this, do you think?
I remember reading for about 10, maybe 15 years ago, a prediction from a political analyst that said the civil service is most likely to become not just a patronage network, but a system that hires on a generational basis. So you'll get, you know, a father and a mother who've worked in the civil service for their entire careers, and their children will be hired into the civil service as well, and their children's children will be hired into the civil service. It becomes an institution that's generational over time. And I remember reading this at the time going, that's not going to happen. They have, surely they have guardrails in place to avoid those sorts of conflicts of interest. Well, you know, fast forward and you're starting to get hints of this sort of thing happening where I'm not talking about nepotism. I'm talking about lack of guardrails to allow compromise like this happen. And I think good on Winston Peters for pointing out that he might be sniffing that there is a more deep corruption going on in the civil service that we probably need to be talking about as a country.
Yeah, I think that's about right. I think there is sort of some dodgy things going on there, particularly when we think about Manurewa Marae and that sort of stuff. I mean, that's
precisely
nepotism. That's terrible. Anyway, let's move on to so there's some significant gang raids recently carried out across the North Island. 28 gang members arrested, 99 charges brought across I think Waikato, Bay of Plenty, Auckland regions. Several people like Tamaiti and other people associated with the sort of the mongrel mob side of it are upset about this. They're saying, you know, gang members have been, you know, the police have busted into the house and dragged the gang member away in front of their family. I think, you know, of course you're going to arrest people at their house. That's where you'd expect them to be. I don't know how else you can do it. And I think, you know, the despite what the academics say, I think the best way of reducing crime is to arrest people and put them in jail. Most crimes are committed by a relatively small proportion of people, and if you take them off the streets, they no longer have the opportunity to commit crime. So that's my very basic view on how to stop crime, is to lock them up. I think it works. I think Nayib Bukele did that in, is he El Salvador? Is that the right country?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, I think he proved that it works. A lot of people are against it, but I think it works. So I'm all for this. I think it's good. Your view?
Yeah, I 100% agree. The gangs are best thought of as local centres of power that are in rival to the government, no matter sort of no matter what that government size. You can see this, that if they are allowed to metastasize, they become the mob or the mafia, La Cosa Nostra, all that sort of thing. Even what El Salvador was dealing with, they're actually rival governments in themselves. Cartels in Mexico, for instance, there are places that Mexico City can't reach jurisdictionally because the local centers of power, known as the drug cartels, control that land. You let this get out of hand, as it was and as it was getting during the Labor government, and it's really hard to clean up. You have to go deeper because they become, you know, almost businesses in themselves, and they start to shell their money, shell their companies, and the government has a tough time cleaning up something that it should have nipped in the bud. So this isn't the bud, but I think the police have been given a clear instruction from not just the state, but probably the attorneys general, that this is something they need to finish before the next election, and all power to them, I'd say.
Okay, staying on the theme of gangs, David Seymour's come in for a little bit of controversy in the media because he's said, well, I don't think that the Nazi swastika should be banned on free speech grounds. However, He supports the ban on gang patches, and a lot of people, I think, correctly have pointed out, well, I mean, the gang patch, like the Black Power fist, for example, what's the difference between that and a swastika? They're both kind of symbols that have some kind of political overtone, or, you know, group identity kind of overtone. How can you be for banning one but not the other? And I think the people making that criticism are basically correct, and David Seymour needs to be consistent and allow all symbols of this nature to not be banned due to the basic free speech argument. Do you have a different view, or agree?
I'd say it just very connects well to what we were talking about before, and also earlier with the COVID inquiries as well. You've got to be careful what you wish for when the government creates policies like this, because anti-gang patches can very quickly become, oh, people who decide to call themselves anti-vaxxers also shouldn't be allowed to congregate and shouldn't be allowed to have their own logos or anything. So it becomes a very versatile tool, shall we say. I think if gangs were getting together to farm the land and make corn and wheat to sell into the market, no one would care. What bothers people about gangs is that they are criminal organizations, and the government should be more focused on whether gangs are committing crime or not. That's where they should be nipping them. But calling them bad or deciding to create new powers based on the clothes they wear, I think is a little bit further down the river. They should be going upstream a little bit more to where the crime is actually happening.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, moving on. Takuta Ferris, who's already in hot water, I think, for comments he's made in Parliament, has misbehaved again in a select committee talking about the Marine and Coastal Areas Amendment Bill. So Muriel and Frank Newman were providing an oral submission to the committee. Muriel was a friend of RCR. She comes on regularly and provides us with her her perspective, her information. She's the head of NZCPR. They do excellent work on political analysis. And they were providing the oral submission to the committee, and Takuda called them effing racists in the middle of the committee. And the committee chair, James Meagher, he said, "Oh, thank you for that comment, Mr. Ferris." But this is just another example, I think, something Winston has been on about, the falling standards around Parliament. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. It's uncouth. I don't think going back to what we were talking about before, our grandparents wouldn't recognise the sort of politeness or lack of politeness that we deal with each other, especially in positions of high status like politicians. However, you could look at it the other way, and from Muriel Newman's perspective, anybody that supports her, you only really get flack like that if you're over the target. So what exactly made Takuta Ferris frustrated was, as far as I understand, that the committee was actually discussing loosening up or changing how much power Maori lobbies had over the foreshore and seabed. And historically speaking, this has been a large basket of opportunity, political opportunity for the Maoris for years. And they are clearly having an allergic reaction to having some of that power being taken away, potentially, or that basket shrinking. And I think that's probably a good sign that they should anybody who wants to create a more equal New Zealand where all New Zealanders are treated fairly should be pushing on that sore, because it's clearly creating a reaction that shows there's some guilt there. And I think, you know, good on Muriel Newman for actually bringing up some good points there.
Yeah, okay. I'll make this the last issue. And this is an interesting one. It's about an interview we aired recently on RCR with Eric Crampton. And he came on and he talked about birth rates, the falling birth rates in New Zealand. And there were a lot of interesting things discussed there. So I'll just go into a couple, which I think are a couple of the more important ones. The first is around feminism, right? And women's liberation, women increasingly working, going into the workplace. And in order to progress with your career, you have to invest a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of hours, which means puts you into preferring work and away from raising children to a certain extent. And this sort of cultural shift in favor of work and away from raising children is one of the key drivers, I think, of falling birth rates. I'll let you take it from there while I recover my voice.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, feminism is a sort of a broad house of criticism that lots of people can sort of throw barbs at. But really, I think what's going on here is that the status of being a mother is not treated the same as the status of striving to become CEO or have that corner office. And I think that's because women themselves have forgotten the power of being a mother. You know, just if you think about it from a philosophical perspective, everybody's got a mother, and that mother was their dominating influence within the first 5 or 6 years of their life. The most pivotal years of every person's life was their mother. A lot of how people turn out as adults is based on those first 5 to 6 years. I don't think women have sort of, and grandmothers these days haven't told their young granddaughters just what that means, that they're actually, that mothers are probably the most powerful institution in any country. And that's extremely high status. Lots of old classical myths, stories always have the mother of the king around, or the mother of the general, or somebody, the mother of the hero. And there's a reason for that. It's because in history, it's been considered a very high status position. And it's not just biological, it's actually sociological, it's political, it's psychological. There's lots of those things, but we've lost that story and replaced it with actually the most high status position a woman can strive to be is in the corner office or with CEO. It doesn't matter if she ages out and her eggs no longer work and she can't have kids at 45. What matters is that she has a large bank account and an acronym before her name. And that's fine for some women. They aren't built for that. But a lot of women these days are getting to that point when they're turning around and going, maybe I shouldn't have walked down that path. Maybe I should have tried something else. And that before anything changes for birth rates, the status of mothers needs to be championed more. And that's really up to you and I, really.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's something wrong in the culture where we're not valuing our motherhood as highly as what we should. And I think real effort needs to be made to reverse that. The other thing Eric Crampton said, and this is more of on the economic side, is around housing and housing costs. So I guess in terms of the economic burden, the economic barriers to starting a family, family formation, having a house, buying a house would probably be like the biggest economic barrier. And house prices are sort of going up quite a lot in the Western world. And a lot of that has to, particularly in some countries more than others, has to do with large rates of immigration, jacking up the housing costs because of increased housing demand. And so I think that this is a key part of it. Too many immigrants jacking up house prices, making it prohibitively expensive to, you know, get together, buy a house, have children, causing people to delay the decision to have children until they've sort of bought a house. That, I think, is a key problem and something we need to address in terms of the economic incentive. So I would reduce immigration and build more houses, basically, is my solution to that. I don't know what you think about it.
Yeah, it is a very economics answer. But I would have to point out that the most demographically healthy places in New Zealand tend to be the locations with the most state housing, for instance. And the most demographically healthy places in the world tend to be places in the third world where, you know, very few people actually own a decent house or have a decent income. So I'm not sure that really cuts in the sense. I think it does come back to the mindset people have about having children. Are they being encouraged to have children, and is it a status symbol at all? Because you can have five kids and you're renting a house, or you can have no kids and you're renting a house. All it comes down to is whether or not you want kids and whether you see that as being a thing that is going to increase your status and your enjoyment of life or not. And I think, you know, our grandparents would be laughing at us saying, oh, we don't have our own house. We don't own our own house. Therefore, we can't have kids. They would say, have kids. It doesn't matter where you live. If you want them and you want some sort of generational legacy, have kids. Because if you wait too long, you won't be able to have them. And there's no point in waiting for house prices to move because they always move, usually up. So I think it's a procrastination argument people have, but it is a very economics argument to have because all they really deal with is numbers. So change the numbers, change the economic incentives, and that's sort of how they see things. But there are some things in this life that economics can't talk about very well, and that is what happens between the years.
Yeah, not everything's about money. Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining me, Nathan.
Thank you for having me.
And next week, I think Dewa will be back again, so we'll resume our regularly scheduled programming. I'm looking forward to having Dewa back. But I've enjoyed having these couple of conversations with you, so I hope our audience has enjoyed something a little bit different as well. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you back next week on The Dialogue.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to? Or dislike what you're listening to. Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. So connect with us today.